Welcome to Wheel Bearings, episode 152. This time around, it's just me, Sam Mabul Sandwich from Guidehouse Insights, and
Rebecca Linland from Rebecca Drives. It's just the two of us.
How are you doing, Rebecca?
I'm good, thank you. I've had a busy, fun week.
Oh, yeah. And it's been just a busy day today, in fact. You know, we've had two new vehicles launched today that we're going to talk about later on. But first, you've been driving some fun stuff, some stuff that I have not yet ever driven.
Oh, ever?
Never. Oh, I've never driven one.
Oh, gosh. Okay. So, yes, I had the opportunity the last, it was about 10 days to drive two Aston Martins. So I first drove an Aston Martin about 3 years ago. They invited me over to the DB11 convertible or Volant. And over, but in the UK. And I said, you know, I've only driven on the left side of the road once. And they said, that's okay. We'll get you one beforehand. And I'm like, that doesn't really count. But okay. So they got me one. They got me one here in the States, which was
they get you a right-hand drive one to drive over here.
I know. Right. No, they got me like an Americanized one. And it was a lot of fun, obviously. And then when I went over to the UK, then I drove the left-hand drive. I don't know what I'm
sure. Right-hand drive on the left-hand side of the road.
Left-hand side of the road, yes. Which is terrifying. Now, fortunately, I was with the absolutely delightful, lovely Lynn Woodward, who actually spent a lot of time in the UK as a child. So she moved to the States when she was 15. She's much more well-versed in driving because she goes back and forth quite a bit. And so she really guided me through, but we had more of those crazy roundabout things, which are actually a lot easier because at least you can follow the traffic. Mm-hmm. The concern, the issue that I had was turning because I didn't know where to look last, you know, and it was
when you make right it here, the challenge is when you're making left-hand turns, you have to look to the right. You're making left-hand turns. You have to look to the left. Before you cross over the traffic over there, it's the opposite. You have to look. When you're making right-hand turns, you have to look to the right before you cross over.
Yes. So I did actually pull out in front of a tanker that I ordinarily would have never done. But yes. So after one brief squeal, everything got back to settled me down. I've gotten the chance a number of times, thankfully, due to some nice relationships I have with them, to drive the Vantage Coupe a couple of times. And this was the first time that I had some time to spend at home here, you know, as like a, I don't want to say daily driver, but so anyway, so the first one that I had was the Vantage Coupe, which, you know, it's this really cool, great looking little two-door coupe. It is truly a two-seater. There's no back seat to
a proper
mess around.
Sports car.
Proper sports car. 503 horsepower, 4.0 liter, turbo V8, 8-speed automatic. Unfortunately, because I would have loved to have had a manual. But, you know,
did they offer one anymore?
They do. Aston Martin has vowed to always offer manuals. Yes. So, yeah, now that was under Andy Palmer's tutelage, which we'll see what happens with the new AMG guy. But, you know, the car itself is just an absolute blast. I mean, it's small. It's, you know, it's my niece described it as nearly claustrophobic. And I'm like, yeah, it is. But, oh, my gosh, it's like just a little rocket ship. Like, the thing's unbelievable, right? It's so much fun. It just goes and goes and goes and goes. And it's just, it's an amazing vehicle all around. I think that, you know, there was a couple of things that I had. I was a little concerns I had. The visibility can be definitely tough in it. There's sensors all around, which help. But visibility is, it's not ideal. You know, like you and I have talked about a lot, those high belt lines, those really narrow greenhouses make for a fantastic looking vehicle. It does not make for a great vehicle to see out of, yeah. You know, but that's okay. The other thing that was a little surprising on this one was that it was actually, it was noisier than I expected it to be. And I actually met Nicole Wakeland, one of our friends, our colleagues, for lunch, and I had her go with me. And she said the same thing. And I feel like I always comment on NVH, but she, and that, which is nice, I have an opinion on this one. But it was just a little, it sounded like there was a lot of noise coming from the A pillar in particular.
Like wind noise?
Wind noise, or, right, okay. Yes. Yeah, wind noise very specifically. You know, the engine, of course, is incredible. It sounds just unbelievable. And there's two guys at the Aston Martin factory that their only job is to tune the exhaust note. And they should definitely get Grammys because they're just gorgeous. The cabin noise, the wind noise in particular, and I felt like it was coming from the A-pillar. Nicole said she felt like her window needed to go back. You know, it's like she kept checking to make sure her window was sealed up enough. Now, interestingly, I did not at all have that same issue with the next Aston that I had, which was the DB11. And that thing was a really tight little cocoon. So that wind noise may have just been, you know, these are all hand-built cars. Maybe there was just a little bit of an issue there, but otherwise it was, you know, incredible to drive. The infotainment system, which is not why you buy this car, it's really bad. It's very clumsy to use. It really needs an upgrade. There was no Android Auto or Apple CarPlay offered. It's really a little bit embarrassing, I think, for a car. The Vantage, the base price is $152 and change. The one that I drove was $192,000. I felt like they really, the infotainment system, I don't know who supplies it, but it's really lacking. And, you know, and again, it's not why you buy the car, but it was, you know, in this day and age, you expect a little bit better. What I find with the Astons is that there's, you know, they are authentically driver focused. They are so responsive. There's such a feeling of surety on the road. Like they're really planted. You know, it's a wide base, even in this small car. The stance is so wide, and it's a little cliche, but you know, the tires are pushed all the way to the corners. There's very little overhang. The proportions are amazing on it. And you just feel like you're always in control with that, driving that kind of car. You just feel like you're always in control. So that was really, really cool. It's I always consider it a privilege to drive a car like an Aston.
I would certainly consider it. I think we have to consider it a privilege to drive any kind of really ridiculously expensive,
yes,
car,
exactly,
like that. You know, yes. It's, you know, I mean, we're getting paid somewhat, you know, for, yeah, for the, you know, for the opportunity to, you know, give our feedback on these things. You know, the vast majority of people never even see one of these things. And
yes,
happen to live in, yeah, Hollywood or somewhere, much less actually get to drive one. So, you know, to have something like this delivered to us, you know, we can't, it's the word I'm looking for. You can't take it for granted. You know,
no, I'm sorry. I mean, not at all. And when you talk about not even seeing one, Aston has built, they've built between 90 and 100,000 cars. I don't think they're at the 100,000 unit mark yet.
Actually, I think they hit 100,000 a few years ago. Yeah.
Well, no, because when I went to see them, they were at 80. Because...
I vaguely seem to recall them hitting 100,000 a year or two ago.
Okay, maybe they've just hit it. So when I toured the factory, they said that basically they've built as many cars in their life, for their existence, as Toyota builds in about 48 hours.
Yeah, that's about right. Yeah, I recall when I was younger. Like, you know, this was back in the 80s, I think, reading that they, at that time, they had just built their 10,000th car ever.
Wow.
Yeah. And this, well, this is a company that's been in business for 100 years.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's like 100 and something now. Yeah. I mean, it is beyond exclusive. You know, this is definitely the kind of car that people come out and look at and ask you about and want to talk about. And when Nicole and I met for lunch, you know, somebody in the parking lot stopped and was like, can I just look at it? And I let him sit in it. And oh my gosh, like it was really cute. You know, he was just so excited. And so it's really, it's a special brand. And they, you know, for better or for worse, they've historically gone bankrupt
numerous
seven or
times.
Eight times, right? Yeah. And what's fascinating is that most of the time they're actually saved by their owners, because there is such a loyalty and emotional attachment to the vehicles. And that's what these vehicles inspire in people. And so, you know, it's just, they're really, really unusual. And we have to figure out when you can drive one. So the next one that I had that I'll just go over briefly was the DB11 V8 coupe. This one is actually more of a four-seater. I mean, I have my two nephews in the back. It is. I have my two nephews in the back. They were delighted. My small, young 4 and 8 year old nephew.
Yeah, not the 25-year-old.
Not the 25-year-old. But you know, it's nice to at least have that as an option when you need it. This one actually has the same engine in it. It's the 4.0 liter twin turbo V8. I liked the Vantage a lot. It was tons of fun. I adore the DB11. It has this brawny elegance to it that's just such perfection to me. I absolutely loved it. Both cars have drive modes that you can put them in. So you can put them in GT, which is Grand Touring, which is a nice, you know, it's not soft, which I love. There's still a feeling of emotion to the road in GT. And then you put it in sport and just blah, 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 even more. And then you put it in sport plus, and all you really want to do is go find tunnels. Yeah. Like, just to keep driving. Just because the sound of it is so incredible. So the DB11, this one starts at 205,000. The one that I drove was 235. Funnily enough, it still had the terrible infotainment system in it, but this one was one that, you know, I just drove it and drove it and drove it and drove it because I just loved it. I absolutely loved it. Again, it's definitely a bigger vehicle. It's a heavier vehicle. There's just that elegance to it. I'm not doing it justice at all. Both of the cars, they're not daily drivers. You don't want to be driving these things every single day, running all these different errands. You know, the gas mileage is terrible. We don't care if you're spending $235,000 on
if you can drop a couple hundred grand on a car, you don't care about gas mileage.
You don't care about it. It really is just, they're incredible vehicles. I absolutely love them. So the DB11 wins out for me. If you can spring for the extra $35,000, I'd go for the DB11. And, you know, from a corporate standpoint, they are actually, you know, the Vantage is a little bit of a disappointment. There's a lot of discussion about the front grille. It's enormous. It's very shark-like looking. And I get that, but I can also see why somebody's in that price point and you're like, you know what, I'm going to pitch and go a little bit higher and go to the DB11 because it's just such a fantastic vehicle.
Yeah. And the DB11 has a little bit more of the, at least what has become the traditional iteration of the grill. It's more like the Astons that we've had, you know, since the early 1990s when the DB7 arrived.
Yes.
And to what you were saying earlier about the company being rescued by its owners from bankruptcy, the DB in the names of Aston Martins comes from David Brown, who was an owner that rescued Aston Martin from bankruptcy in the late 1940s. And, you know, they started naming the cars after him all the way up to the present day. There's always been a DB model in the lineup, and currently you have the DBX, the DB11, and the DBS, along with the Vantage.
Right. So the DBX is their SUV that's coming out. It's been delayed. I did get a chance to look in it, sit in it. There's been some reveals around. And I think this is such a great vehicle for the brand because actually 50% of all their sales in China are women.
Wow.
I mean, it's, yeah.
That's surprising.
It is. And, and when I've worked with them, like at Pebble Beach, I've done some informal judging for them and listening to owner stories. There's always a number of women that I've interviewed that own. I was doing specifically the Gaydon, where the factory is the Gaydon V8s. And there's always women there. Like, one woman was a surgeon and she's like, after when I finally paid off my loans, I got an Aston Martin. Another woman was a cancer survivor and she's like, I just went out and I had to get one. And, she had her name engraved in it. Like, this is the kind of stuff that they do. And I will tell our listeners, if you ever get a chance, if you're in the UK and you get a chance to do a factory tour, definitely try and get over to Gaydon. They actually have a little showroom as well there. And it's just a fascinating place to be able to see things made by hand. And,
they're not as handmade as they used to be though. I mean, when I first read about Aston Martin, became aware of them in the early 80s, when I was a teenager, at that point, the Gaydon factory didn't exist yet. They were still building all their cars, in these workshops in Newport Pagnell.
Yes.
In those days, in the early, and actually they continued building those cars up until the early 90s. At that time, the body panels, they were not stamped in stamping presses. They were hand formed. Everything was, these were as hand built as you could get. They had a crew of craftsmen that, formed every aluminum body panel,
which is why they built 10,000 or less.
Yeah, and every engine was assembled by hand. They had four people whose sole job was to assemble engines. And this is where the idea of putting a nameplate on each engine with the engine builder's signature on it came from. Long before other companies started doing it, they were doing it. And I don't know how if it's apocryphal or not, but I remember reading that some Aston enthusiasts could tell by the way the engine felt and sounded which of those four guys actually built that particular engine.
So a friend of mine that doesn't work there anymore, but worked there for a number of years, he could actually tell who had done the hand stitching. He can tell which seamstress.
Just from looking at the stitches?
From looking at the stitches, yes.
Wow.
Because whether they were right-handed or left-handed. And then he got to know them well enough to know which seamstress did which car.
Yeah. Wow. So my understanding is that now the old workshops in Newport, those are used for the restoration part of the business.
Yes. Yeah. So we did a tour of that as well and saw, one-offs and just incredible. And we couldn't take any pictures, of course, which was a tragedy. But yeah, it's really, it's a special brand and they've had a lot of struggles. And more recently, now that they're public, their struggles, as we talked about on a previous episode with Andy Palmer getting the sack, it'll be really interesting to see how they do on the DBX launch. That is absolutely the most important vehicle that this company has had in decades.
Yeah, and the DBX is coming out of a new plant in Wales, I believe.
Yes. Correctly. Yeah. I'll get the name of it.
Yeah.
So,
all right. So, Aston Martins, you approve?
I approve.
Okay.
Go get one.
I'll get right on that.
Yes.
I, on the other hand, drove something a little more pedestrian, but still a hell of a lot of fun. I had the latest 2020 Mazda Miata, and I posted some pictures. I had it parked next to mine, 30 years apart, and yet still very much the same DNA. So this is the the latest generation Miata last year for the, actually for the 2019 models, they did an upgrade. So the current fourth generation Miata, I think, debuted in 2016, if I recall correctly. And then last year, they got an engine upgrade. So it's still a 2-liter four cylinder, but it went from 155 horsepower to 181 and 151 foot pounds of torque. And I was fortunate enough to get one that had the 6-speed manual in it, which was absolutely lovely. I believe that is the only way that Miatas should be built.
That is how God intended them. Yes,
exactly. Yes. or you know, a 5-speed will do as well, which is what mine has. But, yep. But you know, six is good. The one I had was the Grand Touring. So the Miata comes in three trim levels now: the Sport, which is the base model, the Club, which is the more hardcore, you know, this is if you want to do some track day work with it or really press it hard on the back roads, the Club is the one to get, because that's got it's got the Brembo brakes and strut tower brace and a few other upgrades to make it handle a little better.
Why do they call it the Club?
Because it's the one that's intended if you're doing some club racing with it.
Oh, okay. So it literally is like represents the racing club.
Yeah. So it's the most hardcore edition of the Miata. And then the Grand Touring is the more luxury trim level. It's got leather seats and things like that. But you lose the strut tower brace on that one. Not, you know, I mean, for normal driving on the road, you know, unless you're taking it to the track, you're not really going to notice the difference with the strut tower brace. And the Brembo brakes are an extra cost option on that one if you want them. But, you know, I mean, this car is so light that, especially for, you know, if you're driving it on the road, you don't really need the Brembos. You know, like I said, if you're going to really thrash it hard on the track or even on back roads, then the Brembos are great. You know, extra thermal capacity, always a good thing. But, you know, I drove this thing around and just had a blast with it, just as I've had with every Miata.
I had one last year also had a manual. I think I'm hoping that they only put manuals in the fleet, right?
No, there are some automatics in the fleet.
Okay. Mine was the convertible RF.
Okay. So that's the retractable hardtop semi-retractable hardtop.
Yeah.
So this was the soft top.
All sorts of fun.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just it's such a purist car. I love that.
Well, the soft top is really the purest one. The RF is not quite as pure.
No, but the Miata in general.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And the soft top, this is the best soft top in the world. You know, there's a single latch, you know, right on the windshield header, press a button, pop it back and push it down and you're done. You know, 5 seconds and you're done. And then, you know, if it starts to rain or something, you want to put it up or you just want to park it with the top up, you know, just press the latch right over your shoulder, pull it up, twist it, and you're done. You know, very, very simple.
Love it.
It's great. You know, and you know, the thing about this Miata compared to the ones or at least compared to mine, you know, for example, you know, contemporary Mazdas, you know, we've talked about this with all the other Mazda models, you know, at their relative price points, you know, they have probably the most premium feeling interiors you're going to find anywhere.
Yes.
You know, in their price segments. And the same applies to the Miata. You know, the one I had, was the Grand Touring, you know, with a bunch of options on it and with the delivery charge, came to $32,790. So $33,000. Yeah. And this feels, it feels so nice. You know, you've got really great fit and finish, great materials in it. You know, but it still feels like a Miata, you know, like a proper sports car, roadster, you know, very elemental. Whereas mine, you know, I mean, for its time, you know, 1990. You know, it was more hard plastics. You know, you didn't find materials like this in a car at that price point in 1990. So, you know, and it's funny, you know, driving mine and the new one back to back, you know, it's still, it is raw you know, and it you know, they both feel very similar in a lot of ways, but you know, mine, you know, again, going back 30 years, you know, the way vehicles were built, the structures were not as solid. Mine feels almost delicate by comparison. You know, you close the doors, it doesn't have that really solid feel. And you know, and the belt line on the new one is a little bit higher than on mine. You feel like yours,
like I remember, like I felt like my shoulders were out of the car.
Yeah, they are. mine are, when I'm driving it, my shoulders are definitely out of the car. Yeah. And that's not the case with the new generation ones. But you know, you still, when you put that top down, you know, you still have that perfect 360 degree visibility, you know, and the new one feels so solid. You know, and it feels like it could actually survive if you hit something, whereas mine, not so much. Not as bad as, you know, I think, you know, if you crash tested my Miata and Todd Lasse's Sprite, you know, I mean, it would be no contest. Mine would definitely win. But compare mine to the new generation, totally different story. You could feel safe driving the new one.
Right.
And you know, if you go for the base sport trim, let me find that tab again here. The sport trim starts with a manual transmission at 26,580, $900 for the destination charge. So 27 and a half, you know, out the door.
That's awesome.
For a base one. And you're getting the exact same powertrain, you know, as what's in the club or the Grand Touring. You know, I mean, it's a great bargain. If what you want is a really fun to drive sports car, you know, that you can put the top down and just go anywhere. You know, it's fantastic. You cannot beat a Miata. You know, there's a reason why they came up with the retronym, you know, for Miata. You know, Miata is always the answer, you know, to any question about what should I buy.
That's awesome. Yeah, no, I think I love that kind of purist vehicle too. Like its only job is to drive well. Yes. You know, it's there's nothing utilitarian about that. And in the land of SUVs, it's really fun to get into a car like that.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, certainly, you know, you're not going to be taking, you know, a family anywhere in this thing. I mean, the Miata is perfectly sized for myself, my wife, and our dog.
Yeah.
and we have a small dog. So, you know, that it's, but, you know, I just love driving Miatas. You know, every Miata I've ever driven has been so amazing to drive. And with that extra bit of power that it's got now, that, you know, 181 horsepower now, you know, it's just got that extra thrust that really, you know, it's just exactly what it needed. You know, I think a few years ago when the Fiat 124 came out, and the 124 is based on the Miata. Fiat FCA did a deal with Mazda to rebadge the Miata. So the 124's got different bodywork on it. The interior is exactly the same, except for the Fiat badges. But you know, because with the extra bodywork, it ends up weighing about 100 pounds more than a Miata.
You feel that.
You do feel it. But at the time, you know, the Fiat was the only one, you know, they had the turbocharged 1.4 liter in there, and it, I think it's about 176 horsepower and more torque. So it felt a little stronger than the Miata did. So, you know, in terms of handling, you definitely feel that extra 100 pounds because, you know, you're talking about a car that starts at 2,300 pounds and you're going to 24. So that makes a more noticeable difference.
Right.
Mine is only 2,100 pounds. But you know,
for
a modern, you know, for a 21st century car, you know, 2,300 pounds is remarkably light.
Yes.
And now, you know, with the engine upgrade, you know, there's no reason at all to buy the Fiat anymore.
Yeah, no, that's true. I remember I had the Fiat as well, and it was still fun. It was a great car. I love the looks of it, but it didn't drive exactly the same. It was definitely a different feeling to it. And I preferred the Miata. I thought it was just that much more fun. Yeah. There was just something really, I love the purity of it. You know, it's very authentic. They haven't changed it dramatically from generation to generation. It's still like your 30-year-old Mazda, the Miata, stands up proudly. next to the brand new one.
You feel you feel that same DNA in those two cars.
Right. Absolutely.
Aside from the improved body structure, the other main differences are, you've got a lined top,
right.
Instead of, an unlined top. And what was the other thing? I can't remember now. It doesn't matter.
There's more safety features and there's more regulations.
Yeah, you got airbags.
And things like
airbags
that.
Airbags on both sides.
But no, I think it's fantastic. That's awesome. Yeah.
With that out of the way, let's move on. Today was, as we mentioned earlier, was a busy day. There was two product introductions. The first was a vehicle that was supposed to show up at the New York Auto Show, which in April, which obviously didn't happen. And then the second was scheduled to debut at the Detroit Auto Show last week, which also, for reasons we don't need to get into, didn't happen. And there's actually going to be several more product introductions over the next several weeks. But let's start off with the Nissan Rogue, the 2021 Nissan Rogue. And we both saw the online introductions of both of the vehicles we're going to talk about. What'd you think of the Rogue?
So I really liked the way the Rogue looks. I think that it has more personality. But it has more personality than the previous version of it, for sure. And, this segment is really, really tough because this is a compact SUV. There's a lot of competition in this segment. It's the buyer doesn't always want a ton of personality in their car. This is kind of, that dreaded term of like, it's an appliance. Like, it's kind of like, this is the way I get from A to B. But I feel like, especially on the front end, they've done a really good job of introducing a new design language.
It's an updated version of it.
Right. But, I think the headlamps are really cool. I think it looks really good. I'll be really curious to see what it looks like in person. But I think there's a lot of personality to it. It looks pretty modern and very sharp lines. And I liked it. I think it looks cool.
Yeah. This segment, the compact crossover, is, aside from, full-size pickup trucks, which obviously rule the roost in North America, this is the segment that has supplanted mid-size sedans as the biggest mainstream segment in the U.S., for 20 odd years, the Toyota Camry was the best selling car in North America and in U.S. And now it's the RAV4. The RAV4 sold, over 400,000 units last year. And the Rogue in 2018 sold 412,000 units, dropped off to 350,000 last year. But, this is an enormous segment, and there's a lot of competition in this segment. You've got the RAV4, the Honda CR-V, the Ford Escape, the Hyundai Tucson, the Kia Sportage, the Chevy Equinox. Even the Equinox, which most people never even think about anymore.
Right.
Yeah, I mentioned the Escape.
Oh, sorry.
Even the Equinox, which hardly anybody thinks about, right. Sold 350,000 units last year.
Crazy.
It's an enormous product segment, and it's a really, it's really competitive.
It is. It's an everyman car. It's got something for everybody. It's the right size. If you're a young family, if you're single, if you're an empty nester, it has so much utility and so much flexibility. And so it's really hard to kind of stick out from the crowd in some ways, because and especially because the competition just keeps getting better and better. They're making them more premium feeling and looking, and it's just an incredibly, incredibly competitive segment.
Yeah, when I first saw the pictures of the Rogue last week ahead of the background briefing that we got before the reveal today, I looked at it and it's immediately recognizable as a Rogue. If you've seen the current generation Rogue, you will immediately recognize this as the new Rogue. Yes, sharper lines, but the proportions are very similar, especially the side glass shape, the way it kicks up at the back.
Right.
It's totally a Rogue. So my question to you is, does it stand out enough, especially, you know, they talked about during the briefing, you know, they talked about how this was inspired by the cross motion concept that they showed in Detroit 2 years ago. And, you know, I included a photo of the cross motion in my story on Forbes. And yes, there is some inspiration there, but, you know, that concept went so much farther than this does. You know, this is really toned back from that concept.
Yeah, but again, I feel like, first of all, I like the front end a lot. I think it looks really good. You know, I just had the Honda CR-V hybrid that I talked about previous episode. And, you know, just comparing the two, I'm leaning a bit actually towards the Rogue in terms of certainly evolutionary styling. I think that, you know, when you think back years ago, the Nissan Murano, when that came out, it may have been almost polarizing in some ways, but that design was, I think the original Murano was really beautiful. Like it was very, very, there was a lot of personality to it. And I feel like Nissan kind of lost their way a little bit from a design standpoint, that like the Quest was just too weird. You know, like there was, they sort of went too far over. So I think that with the Rogue, I think this is that right balance of it has enough personality for those shoppers that want that in their vehicle, but it doesn't have too much that is going to be polarizing or alienating. Maybe some people will consider the headlamps because they do sit kind of high up. But again, like they're not like how weird the Juke was, right? I mean, that Juke was, that's not okay.
That thing was hideous. It drove great. It was a blast to drive.
Oh my gosh.
It burned my eyes.
It was not okay. Yeah. So I think that, you know, I think that the Rogue does that. It's interesting enough for people to realize that it's new, that it's different. But I don't think that it's so weird that they're going to look and say, oh my gosh, you know, that's not good. So I liked it.
Do you think it's enough to grab people's attention away from the rest of the segment?
Well, that's the biggest challenge, right? I mean, I do think that they really need to do a better, you know, advertising is so important in this kind of way to remind people like what it is that makes Nissan different. So, you know, their ProPilot Assist, I think, is really, really cool. And they need to work on their messaging of like what they have and what and why, how is this different than a CR-V, or why should you buy this instead? I mean, that's all marketing in my mind.
Yeah. You know, the ProPilot Assist, you know, this is one of the things that they did upgrade this year. So it's got a new generation of it. Something they call with NaviLink. So what it's doing is it's using the map data, the navigation map data, as an input to ProPilot. So it's not quite to the level of what Tesla claims with their Navigate on Autopilot system, where you know, you can set a destination, and when you're on the highway, it will automatically take, you know, an interchange, you know, to go from one highway to another. But what it does do is, like what GM does with Super Cruise, it looks ahead down the road at the curvature of, or, you know, the radius of curves coming up on the road, and it will automatically adjust your set speed. So if you're coming up to a curve that's a little too tight for the speed you're going at, it'll automatically reduce your speed a little bit so you can get through that curve safely and stay in the, you know, it'll keep it in the lane and then resume your speed afterwards. Similarly, you know, if you're going from one highway to another, you know, and you get off on a ramp, it will, when you move off onto the off ramp, it will automatically lower your speed. It won't take you off, you know, off the road to the ramp. But when you do that manually, when you steer over there, it'll lower your speed until you get back onto the other highway and merge on. Then it'll resume your previous speed. And it's got speed limit assist, so it'll read the signs for the speed limits and make those adjustments automatically as well. So it's got some definite upgrades to it. compared to what they had before. Longer range sensing for the radar and the camera, and you know, various other improvements to the software. So it's definitely should be an upgrade. But from a design standpoint, one other thing I wanted to mention, one of the things that they highlighted during the presentation was, you know, the what they call the floating roof design. And this is a theme that Nissan's had for the last several years since the current generation Murano came out. You know, where but it's typically been, you know, at the C pillar, you know, they'll put a black insert there to give this look of, you know, the back of the roof floating above the rest of the car. In this case, they did the reverse of that. So they blacked out the A pillars. And so you have a solid C pillar. They blacked out the A pillars. So the roof looks like it's floating at the front. But in addition to that, they also adopted the two-tone roof option that they have on the Kicks. So you can get a couple of different color combinations of lower body color and different roof colors like you can on the Kicks.
I think it looks really cool. I like that. It sort of reminds me of the Star Trek Enterprise, like where that the top part kind of juts out. Like if you look at the, yeah. You know, like if you look at it from the
saucer
side,
section.
Right. Yeah, exactly. You know, it has this, it has a very architectural feel to it. And, you know, I like that. I think that's really cool.
I mean, it's a good look.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's neat.
And the one other thing that did bother me about this is that, you know, coming out this year in 2021, there's only one powertrain option. It's an upgraded version of their 2.5 liter four cylinder now with direct injection. Yeah. So I think it's 188 horsepower, if I recall, which is, you know, that's fine. You know, I mean, it's certainly competitive with most of the rest of the segment. There's no V6 or, larger turbo four cylinder option. You know, so you don't have anything that's going to go up against like the 2 liter EcoBoost and the Escape or anything like that. But what they, for reasons that I don't understand, they've opted not to have an electrified powertrain option. So there's no hybrid option available.
Which is really short-sighted considering this heavy competition and others do.
Yeah, I mean, you look at, especially Toyota.
Yes.
You know, the RAV4, you know, is the top-selling vehicle in this segment now. You know, 412,000 units, I think, last year. And 100,000 of those were hybrids.
Wow.
The RAV4 hybrid was the best-selling Toyota hybrid last year, way outselling the Prius now. You know, 1 in 4 RAVs sold in the U.S. last year were hybrids. And, you know, Ford is selling a lot of Escape hybrids. I don't know, you know, the CR-V hybrid's only been on sale for a short time, so we don't have any numbers on that yet. But, you know, increasingly, you know, everybody's offering hybrid, and in the case of both Ford and Toyota, plug-in hybrids as well. You know, so, you know, Dan and I talked about this on the last episode. You know, the Ford Escape plug-in hybrid, you know, got its EPA ratings. It gets 37 miles of electric range on a charge, and the RAV4 plug-in is going to get 42. You know, and you know, no hybrid option at all for the Rogue, which I think is going to be a mistake.
Well, I think it's certainly not going to draw more buyers to them because they'll have competition. So people that are looking for a hybrid will immediately discount them, right, and go someplace else. Now, historically, hybrid sales have been very, very small percentage of the general market. But as you say, again, this type of vehicle, this size vehicle is for a practical utility-oriented consumer that is, you know, where fuel economy is often something that they look at. It's not their number one priority, obviously, but if you can get all this utility and get a hybrid with it as well, they're going to do that. I mean, that's, you know, and that's where I think that Nissan really is missing out. So I'm surprised that they wouldn't have, especially because, you know, their competitive intelligence should have told them that, you know, key players in this segment were going to offer a hybrid. And so it's really a glaring omission in many ways. It wouldn't have been if just a few years ago, I think, right. bag.
Yeah, I mean, definitely, you know, it's definitely something much more prominent now. And, you know, when you look at the sales figures, you know, for the competitors, you know, it's not an insignificant take rate on these things.
Right. Well, and that's the thing is that there may not be a lot of people that say, I want a hybrid CRV, like that verbalize that. But then when they're shopping it and they look and they're like, well, wow, I can get a hybrid version of this, then that's going to be something that they're going to gravitate towards. And so, and again, you know, when you're shopping in this, the mindset of this buyer is very practical oriented. So they put together one of those like comparison charts, you know, like a lot of websites will do for you. And this comes up in fuel economy. You see the difference in fuel economy. I think it's really going to be a disadvantage for them. I think they're going to lose sales because of it.
Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting to see how this one does. It's not going to be out until later in the fall. We'll watch this one. You know, we'll see how it does. So one more product launch today came from Toyota, actually from Lexus, which was the new 2021 Lexus IS. And we actually just watched this reveal on YouTube Live about an hour or so ago. What did you think?
Well, I went first on the Rogue, so I think you should go first on this one.
Okay. So remember what I said about the Rogue looking familiar?
Yes.
This one really gonna look familiar. In fact, if you don't look closely, you may have a hard time telling the difference between this and the current generation IS, which is not a bad thing. I like the IS. I like the way it looks. You know, this one, you know, it's a very subtle, from a design standpoint, a very subtle update. You know, and it's a little more this time like the Lexus RC.
Yes.
You got a little more prominent shoulder, you know, in the rear quarters, like the RC, and the rear glass, the rear roof line, extends back almost to the rear edge of the deck lid. So there's an even shorter deck lid than there is on the current generation IS. It's still rear wheel drive, still basically the same size, the same wheelbase. It's about 1 inch longer overall. But you know, you will immediately recognize this, you know, as an updated. It looks, from a design standpoint, externally, it looks more like a mid-cycle refresh than an all new design. You know, I don't think that that's necessarily a bad thing. I think it's a great looking car. And I think it's, you know, I personally like the size of the IS. I'm not a huge fan of really big cars. So I like this size. And it's launching initially as the IS 300 with the 2 liter turbo four cylinder. And the IS 350 with 3.5 liter V6 that's also in the current generation IS. And then there's going to be an F Sport and presumably at some point maybe an ISF again, but we don't know for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's funny because the front looks exactly the same. I mean, you really have to look for stuff. I do like the rear tail lamps. I think they look cool. Again, I'm hoping that when we get a chance to actually feel the car and run our hands over it and feel some of the lines that they were talking about, that they'll be more visible, because certainly, you know, online on YouTube or whatever, it's not immediately apparent that this is a brand new vehicle. The design language is exactly the same.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is. You know, I'm just sitting here staring at it and it looks exactly the same. I'm not going to.
Yeah. Like I said, not that that's a bad thing. But,
no, it's not a bad thing. But wow, I mean, it's really this.
You know, the funny thing was during the presentation, they did make a big deal out of the design.
Yes.
And I'm sitting here looking at it, you know, and I've got the video of the reveal going on one screen in front of me, and I'm looking at the website, looking at pictures of the 2020 IS, you know, on the other side. I'm looking back and forth. It's like, okay. What's the big deal?
Really, it's like when people get a failed Botox You're like, wait, I don't see the difference. I'm sorry. Yeah. It's just, I mean, as you say, it's a good looking car. I'm sure it's a blast to drive, especially if they, you know, give us some nice tuning, but it's, there's not really a significant difference.
The interior had a more substantial upgrade though.
Well, the interior is beautiful. It does still have that stupid touchpad. I'm stealing your line from our message, but
you know, but it also has a touchscreen, so you don't have to. Presumably, you don't have to use the touchpad.
Well, good. That makes me happy.
Yeah,
we won't go there. No, I think the interior is gorgeous. I mean, they're showing it in black and red, and I think it's great looking. I personally. Just a personal preference. I prefer an integrated screen, but otherwise, you know, I can't fault it. I think it looks really nice.
What I thought was fascinating was during the presentation, and I went and looked at the press photos afterwards, and it matched up. You know, they talked about this new 10.3-inch touchscreen, and they talked about. And it's got Apple CarPlay and Android Auto, yes. And you know, integrated Amazon Alexa. And they never once showed, you know, they showed the CarPlay screen, they showed the Android Auto screen. They never once showed the stock Lexus infotainment screen.
Right. And
none of the images. There's one image in the press kit that has just the Lexus boot up screen, but they never show the stock.
Why is that?
My guess is because most people probably don't like it. I don't know. I have no idea how much it's changed. We can't tell because we haven't seen it.
Right.
You know, certainly the current any current generation Lexus, I don't know anybody who's a particular fan of the Lexus N-Form infotainment system.
No, it's horrible.
Yeah. So, you know, I don't know how much, if at all, they've changed it. It still has the touchpad, which nobody particularly likes either. So we'll just have to wait and see when they show us more detail. But that was an interesting touch that they opted not to show us that, but show the other stuff.
Yeah, no, that is right. That's a good catch for sure. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, again, it's I'll be very, very interested to see it in person, because even looking at like the main picture, I'm not even picking up on some of the new stuff that he talked about with the Beltline and stuff like. It's really hard to discern online without looking at it, the body differences.
Yeah, you know? It's definitely subtle. I mean, I think you can, if you look, you know, at the fascia of the current one and the new one side by side, you can see, you know, there's a bit of reshaping of the spindle grill. You know, the bottom part of it is a little more rounded,
right.
Rather than just, you know, straight trapezoidal. And you know, the outer portions of the fascia are a little bit different, but you know, I mean, it's very much, you know, an incremental update.
Yes.
You know, it's not a radical rethink of Lexus design language.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, of the current Lexus design language, you know, it's picked up a few details maybe from the LC coupe and the new LS, and you know, that's a good thing, but you know, it's very much incremental.
It is, but you know what? We'll see how it looks in person, and you know, see what happens.
Yeah,
I don't know. It'll be, you know, it's. I mean, they've kept a lot of the heritage to it. It's still rear-wheel drive, that 2.0 liter engine. So you know, there's. It's. I think it'll still be a lot of fun to thrash around in.
Yeah, no, it should be good. And they also released a Lexus AR Play app, which we'll put a link to in the show notes that you can. I've downloaded it, but I haven't actually played with it yet see. You know, you can kind of walk around and check out the car in a little more detail. And they talked about you know, this is the first Lexus to debut the Lexus driving signature, which it's not entirely clear what that is. Presumably, it's kind of just the whole feel of the car. You know, this is kind of the direction they're going with Lexus, make it a little more sporty than before. Well,
they need it. They need it.
Yeah.
I mean, they do. You know, they've been so dependent upon the baby boomers for so long, and they need to have something that pulls people in, like sort of, you know, like we were talking about with the Rogue, like give me a reason to buy this car, especially with the declining demand for cars, you've got to give a consumer a good reason to buy this thing. And obviously the design language is not it, you know, the new, because there's not enough of a difference. So they've got to get something from the driving standpoint then that pulls people in.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, well, that's about it for now for the IS. That's, you know, the whole presentation was about 15 minutes, and unlike, you know, traditional in-person presentations, we haven't had a chance to walk around and poke around the interior or talk to the executives afterwards and learn more about their thinking. But, I'm cautiously optimistic about this one. I think it'll be pretty good, especially, you know, if they can infuse it with some of the same kind of fun to drive that's in the LC in particular. You know, infuse that into this thing. I mean, the LC is so great to drive.
It is.
You know, and this is a much more accessible price point. You know, starting in the mid-30s.
Right.
You know, that it should be a hoot.
Yeah, it will be. You know, one thing I did want to, and I mentioned this to you earlier on Slack. At least one generation ago, I think it was 2016, that I remember driving the IS. And there was the bump out for the transmission.
Oh, in the footwell.
In the footwell, yeah. And it was from it being.
Was it like on the floor or on the side?
So it was on the side. Oh, my knee kept hitting something, and then I looked, and they had actually kept the so when you sit in the driver's seat with the on the left hand side, it kept hitting my right knee. Somebody said it was because it was designed for right-hand drive, and they basically just took the steering wheel and put it on the left-hand side, and they didn't move this bump, whatever it was causing this bump. So that's something that, again, like I will, when we get a chance to see the car, that's the first thing that I'll do is to look to see if they've done a full adaptation for this market and for left-hand drive.
Yeah, I don't remember that being an issue, but it's been a couple of years since I drove an IS. So.
Yeah, but you wouldn't have felt it like I did, though, because my seat's up further.
Oh, okay.
So that was one of the things, was that taller drivers, their calf is almost straighter and lower, mm-hmm. whereas mine would be like right at that point. So taller drivers were much less apt to notice it than somebody my size. So I'll be curious to see. They did a good job. Yeah, they did a good job with the online presentation, though.
It was well done. I mean, it was, unlike, I'm trying to remember, the Hyundai Elantra. Updated Hyundai Elantra one. Yeah. This was very early on in the lockdown. This was in late March, early April. Hyundai did they did an online reveal, and they basically did the presentation that they would do at a live event, except it was in an empty studio.
Oh, gosh.
And there was, you know, obviously no audience there.
Right.
And it was really weird and creepy, you know, so they were doing the same show they would have done at an auto show or, you know, at a media event, but just with nobody there.
Yeah. That's weird.
You know, and whereas this one, you know, they had a bunch of pre-recorded segments and they edited it all together. You know, they had Townsend Bell and Dave Crist from Lexus. You know, Townsend Bell drives one of the Lexus RCs in the IMSA GTD class, and it was well executed this time around. But I'll be curious. There's, you know, we're going to be seeing a bunch of other ones. You know, last week for the Rogue, Nissan just, you know, it was a media only one. They just did a Zoom call. A video Zoom call and did the presentation on there. And Ford's got a couple of reveals coming up over the next few weeks with the new F-150 next week or the week after.
I didn't get an invite to that.
It's on the 23rd of June. And then the Broncos coming up on July 9th.
Right.
So curious to see what they do with those two.
For sure. All right, cool.
All right. Well, thank you so much, everybody. And, keep tuning in and we'll have more content for you.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.